Okay. So the good news around mindfulness practice is that by paying attention to what's going on moment by moment, we increase the amount of choice we have in our life. We also increase the number of possibilities we have also. So the increased possibilities comes also with increased choice, which is very, very nice. And choice is connected to intention. The intention or the motivation that's expressed in the choice that we make. And this is maybe a little thing aside, but I went to have dinner today at a little taqueria, and where I often have dinner sometimes when... I had a lot of time. So I just wasn't in a hurry to have my dinner and go on someplace else. I just had a lot of time, and I showed up, and there's no one else there, and I stood at the cashier to kind of order the table at the cashier. And so I was in no hurry to order. And I was just standing there and kind of, I knew what I wanted. I didn't have to look at the menu. And so the woman behind at the cashier taking my order, she seemed to have all the time in the world too. And so, you know, I was pretty relaxed and she was pretty relaxed and she seemed happy and I was happy. And so there was this wonderful moment there. Kind of we looked at each other and made contact in the eyes and made this nice smile. And then there was kind of this wonderful exchange as I was ordering my food. It was really delightful. And I reflected about how that wouldn't have happened if I'd come in there in a hurry. I would have kind of quickly ordered my food. I wouldn't have paid much attention to her. And I would have missed the opportunity. There was this wonderful, you know, Zen master there ready to meet me. And I could have missed her if I'd been in a hurry. So this, you know, not being in a hurry, but rather paying attention to what's going on in the moment, increases the realm of possible things that can happen to us, and also increases the amount of choice we have. Another thing that mindfulness does and choice does, mindfulness gives us a chance also for our conscience to come into play. And conscience is a word that I never really used much in this context of teaching Buddhism. But I think it's a very interesting word because conscience literally means with knowing. And with knowing is what mindfulness is, to do things with knowing. And when we are mindful of situations, we can choose better what we want to do because we see the choices there. But also with mindfulness, with the knowingness of mindfulness, there's also a more subtle working of consciousness, of registering and sensing and feeling our way through our choices to see whether they work with our conscience, whatever we want to call that. And also there's often kind of reviewing that happens of our life, and some of the kind of clean conscience or bad conscience that people have come a little bit from reviewing past intentions, the choices we made in the past. The choices we make affect our consciousness. And consciousness can make you sleep good or bad. A clean consciousness will help you sleep, they say. And a bad conscience will make you sleep poorly. So I use the word conscience today because I came across a very interesting report from the United States Senate from 1830. This report was written by a Baptist, a senator from Kentucky. And it used to be that the U.S. Postal Service delivered mail on Sunday. Do you know that? They used to do that. In 1830, they were wondering whether they should stop this and have, you know, Sunday be a holiday for the post people. And so the Senate committee reviewed this issue, and the Baptist... This here it says he was a Kentucky senator and an active Baptist leader. And he wrote this: "The Constitution regards the conscience of the Jew as sacred as that of the Christian and gives no more authority to adopt a measure affecting the conscience of a solitary individual than that of a whole community. If Congress shall declare the first day of the whole week first day of the week holy, it will not satisfy the Jew nor the Sabbatarian. It will dissatisfy both and consequently convert neither. It must be recollected that in the earliest settlement of this country, The spirit of persecution which drove the pilgrims from their native homes was brought with them to their new habitations, and that some Christians were scourged and others put to death for no other crime than dissenting from the dogmas of their rulers. If a solemn act of legislation shall in one point define the God or point out to the citizen one religious duty, it may with equal propriety define every part of divine revelation and enforce every religious obligation, even to the forms and ceremonies of worship, the endowment of the church, and the support of the clergy. It is the duty of this government to affirm to all, to the Jew and Gentile, pagan or Christian, the protection and advantages of our benign institutions, for example, the post office, on Sunday as well as every day of the week. Isn't that something? That was a remarkable thing. And you know, it's long since forgotten, this kind of wonderful concern about the well-being. And this is Christian, right? The well-being of non-Christians, and that we don't want to impose our kind of calendar and our kind of Christian holy days on these people, because the government should not be doing that. And this memory of, you know, just a few hundred years earlier in the United States, that people in this country have been put to death. It's kind of remarkable, you know, how sometimes some people, when they're persecuted, when they get the upper hand, they do the persecuting. And it happened here on this soil, where the people persecuted in England came here, and they got into power, and they persecuted in turn. And one of the remarkable stories of this is a man named Roger Williams, who, I don't know how many of you know about him, but Roger Williams was the founder of the First Baptist Church. There's a kind of a theme here about the Baptists. And he came over, you know, back there in the Pilgrim days to Massachusetts with the, what was it called? Anyway, he came over there with John Winthrop, is that right? Weintrop, Massachusetts Bay Colony. And John Winthrop wanted to have this great vision of building a city on the hill. Maybe it was Boston. I don't know where it was, but a city on the hill. But Roger Williams was concerned that the hill belonged to someone else. And so he wasn't so happy with the policy of just kind of taking from the Indians, taking from the Native Americans, and claiming it for the English and building whatever they wanted to build there. So as a result, he was exiled from the colony in the January of 1669. Now, being exiled from the colony in Massachusetts in January in the 1600s, you know, they didn't have homeless shelters back then like they have now. And, you know, it was kind of like not a very good situation to be in, I suppose. And however, it seems that the Indians took him in, and the Indians took care of him. And he wrote then about, he actually wrote this very poor poetry about but with very noble sentiments about how really courteous the Native Americans were to him, and how, and contrasted this discourteous nature of some of these English that he knew, and how they were had just as much nobility and had just as much of you know, of humanity in them as the English Christians did, and they should be honored for that. And there's something about in the teachings of the Baptists and the early Baptists that was very important for the early Baptists was that of the sacredness of the individual conscience. That each individual conscience, which is in part each individual's freedom of choice, religious choice, was a sacred part of who they were. And you didn't want to interfere with that by imposing your particular religious view on that, even though your religious view might be the right one. You didn't want to impose it because you had to respect the individual conscience, because that was sacred. And so Roger Williams then kind of expressed this with in his early Baptist church. And it also became a view that the Quakers hold. I think one of the beautiful things about the Friends is how they have the idea that within each of us is kind of like a divine, a spark of the divinity, of the divine. And so each individual person's voice, when it speaks from that divine place, is sacred, is, has some kind of ultimate authority, or is special, or is very worthy. And so, as some of you know, the Quakers meet here on Sunday, and they wait in silence until this divine spark gets motivated to speak. And then it speaks not from the individual kind of selfish point of view, but speaks from that divinity, that divine part. It turns out that this Baptist and Quaker idea of the sacredness of individual conscience, individual ability of free choice, was one of the cornerstones. Maybe all of you know this already. One of the cornerstones of the values that went into the founding of the Constitution, the founding of this country. And it was still active enough idea that in 1830, it was very seriously protesting the idea that the post office should close on Sundays. Isn't that interesting?
I think that's happened, that it's now closed on Sundays?
I don't know when that changed. Mm-hmm. I'm going to find out, but right now I don't know. Yeah?
He doesn't want to
offend the Jews or the atheists or anybody else, because then they won't
convert.
Right. So that was very interesting too. And there's scholars who have argued that the whole idea of human rights, which is now a very, very important concept in the world, had its source in this the early Protestant sects, the European and American Protestant sects, like the Baptists and the Quakers, who championed the sacredness of the individual's choice of religion. And from that first kind of idea the human right to religious choice, it spread out into all kinds of other human rights that people have nowadays. I bring all this up because I was wondering and looking at this, I wonder what is comparable in Buddhism? Is there something in Buddhism that is comparable to the idea of the sacredness of the individual conscience, the individual's ability to choose for themselves, for him or herself? Now, one of the things that about Buddhist practice and Buddhist teachings is that it puts the individual very much at the center. The Buddha said that I can only point the way. You yourself have to negotiate the way. You yourself have to put these teachings into practice. You yourself have to be mindful as you go through your lives and then be conscientious about the choices you make, the motivations you have for the actions, that how you respond to situations you find yourself in. That's up to you. The Buddha only shows the way. One of the things that's very sacred, I would use the word sacred in this context perhaps, is in the Buddhist tradition, is each person's potential for liberation, for awakening, for freedom. And it's something, awakening is something that resides only in the individual. And it's one of the great gifts and challenges that Buddhism offers to all of us, is the possibility for each of us to cultivate our ability to be mindful, to have enough clarity of mindfulness in the present moment, that we can see mindfully enough the choices we have in the present moment, that we can actually not only see, we can see the choices clearly enough that we can be free of all the choices that are possible, that we're not kind of the slaves to whims or slave to habits or slaves to strong impulses and desires. It's quite something, those of you who sit maybe have the sense of sitting, very interesting when you sit to do this, but it can happen any time, to feel a desire arise inside of you. And then to feel the impulse to act on that desire. The desire and the impulse are two different things. But the impulse to act on it has a kind of sometimes can have kind of an addictive quality, or kind of an insistence that says, it has to be now, or... it doesn't say what, but or else. it has to happen now or else. And it can be very compelling, and we can feel that, well, I have to act on it because, it's what we can justify it with all kinds of philosophy. It's my inner self, or it's my deepest sense of self, or it's my true self, or it's whatever. All it is a passing whim. And to sit there quietly in meditation and to feel the desire arise and pass like a wave, and to see that the wave just passes after a few seconds. I think that begins to show you the possibility of being awakened and free and liberated in the midst of a desire, rather than kind of being submerged in the wave when it arises. So does it make some sense to you, this idea? And it happens just with all kinds of things, with anger. To feel anger is just a wave that washes through you. You have a choice of whether you get involved with that wave or not. You have a choice of whether you get involved with the wave of desire or not. And to see that choice, to see there's a choice both to get involved and not to get involved, opens kind of a crack in our normal reactivity. And it's possible to be free instead of caught up or reactive. So Buddhism considers the potential to be free as being so central and so important and so special that I think the word sacred is a very nice way of talking about it. The Buddhists might not use the word sacred, but in the West we might do it. The Buddhists might talk about it as, rather than being sacred, they might talk about it as it has a nobility to it. There's a nobleness to this potential and possibility within us. Yes?
It seems like just because you realize that there is a choice doesn't necessarily mean that you can choose. It seems like, for instance, smokers generally know that smoking is bad for them. Yeah. Say that, that's not.
Right.
So how does that fit?
Well, seeing you have choices is the beginning. It's a very important beginning. And then through various kinds of strategies, you might be able to kind of find ways to break an addiction if the addiction is what's going on. And there's many, a whole range of strategies that are available that can be very useful. I'm not going to go through a list of them now. But as the mindfulness gets stronger and stronger and stronger, the mindfulness provides a kind of a refuge or kind of a source of strength that can be stronger than the addiction itself. And so the strength of the mindfulness then helps us choose other choices. And I've known people who have been alcoholics, for example, and who found it extremely liberating to realize that they can just have the desire for alcohol just arise and pass. You know, they don't have to get on that wave. Whereas they thought, in the past, they thought that it was of course you had to get on it. Or you feel a tremendous amount of sadness or despair or kind of inside of you, which is often a source for addiction. And people can learn through mindfulness that they can just allow it to be there peacefully, that sense of pain, inner pain. They don't have to let that inner pain trigger itself or fuel an addictive behavior. So learning to be comfortable with discomfort is a very important thing if a person wants to become free. If you're not comfortable with the discomfort, you can't be free. So this is some small thing to say. Jean. Okay, maybe say it a little differently then. To be willing to be present for discomfort. It's okay with me to be comfortable. There can be kind of a meta comfort. I've had tremendous physical pain. Tremendous physical pain. And had a tremendous ease of mind at the same time. So in that sense, be comfortable with discomfort. You know, discomfort has many forms. It can be a lot of restlessness can be a form of discomfort. So sit with a lot of restlessness, but there's a kind of okayness to it. I know that when I'm not okay with my restlessness, then I might act out in funny ways. But with the mindfulness, it's possible to be present for it and kind of open the body, in a sense. So the body completely open and becomes a container where the restless feeling inside of me just courses freely within me. And so there's a kind of comfort or kind of ease or kind of non-resistance to the discomfort. Does that make some sense, Jean? Anything else? The possibility of freedom then, the potential for freedom, for non-restriction, not to restrict ourselves by our addictions or our fears or our aversions and all these things. But the contribution of mindfulness practice, or the contribution of Buddhism to focusing on this wonderful potential we have, is that Buddhism at the same time will say, will point to those forces within us that keep us from being free, that keep us from being awakened. If you, those of you who know the Four Noble Truths, it talks Four Noble Truths, or the Four Sacred Truths, this wonderful potential we have, points to the possibility of freedom, of awakening, of cessation of all suffering. And the Four Noble Truths points to the truth of what causes the opposite of freedom, what causes suffering. And so these two things go together. Because if you only focus on freedom, if you only focus on unfettered freedom, whatever way you want to act, it's all too easy for that freedom to be confused with our egotistical desires, our selfish desires, our fears and inhibitions. And so people start acting out in funny ways. You know, I should be free to do whatever I want. It means I'm free to make it, you know, to, you know, people have do all kinds of things which end up causing suffering to people around them. I went to a car dealership this week. I remember last time I went to a car dealership some years ago. The guy said to me, I was driving, test driving the car, and he said, you know, things are always changing. Oh, the only thing that's constant is change, you know. And that woke me up, you know. But that was a justification for that I deserved an air conditioner. What does that have to do with it? I just, you know. So when a tradition focuses on freedom but doesn't have any kind of careful analysis of the forces that keep us from being really free, the forces that keep us bound, then it's very likely that the forces of being bound will act out in funny ways in the name of freedom. And so Buddhism puts a lot of emphasis on clarifying and emphasizing, elucidating what is the forces that keep us bound. So it talks about clinging and desire and addiction. It talks about hate and aversion. It talks about restlessness and sleepiness. It talks about doubt. It talks about these things not so we keep them kind of abstractly know about them, so that we study them and get to know them intimately in ourselves. And because the Buddhist teaching is by intimately knowing these things for ourselves, those forces within ourselves of desire and hate and whatever, and when we're the connoisseurs of them, we savor them, we know them so well, we can be the connoisseurs of them, then we're less likely to be caught by them and confused by them and to act out them in unhealthy ways. If we really want to be free, we need to understand these forces. Yes?
I had a thought. Most of the time when we're young, we learn when you put your hand on the stove, it's hot, you take it off. And I think that as children, we learn to rely on our emotions as keys or as feedback, how other people act towards us.
Yes.
And so this is the analogy is almost like we hop from one thing to another in our reactivity to life. And what Buddha's talking about is recognizing when that's happening. But what happens when you can see it all happening, then what are your choices? What is your motivating right action?
Right. Yes, yes.
Because it's like you're sort of taking all the pegs that hold you up out.
Oh.
How do you act in the world? Do you know what I'm saying?
So I guess what Cheryl is saying is that if your mindfulness is strong enough, and you no longer, you see the range of choices you have, and you see that, and one of the choices is not to act at all, then that's actually a very powerful choice. That's actually more useful than we realize, not choice not to act. But if we see that it's all choice, and our normal kind of habitual reactivity is no longer acting, then what do we base our choices on? Okay. So the second thing I want to talk about, the first thing I said, so what is it in the Buddhist tradition that can be pointed to as being comparable to the idea of the sacredness of the individual conscience? And the first I said is that the potential each of us have for being free. The second thing that can be pointed to as being kind of comparable thing is our intentionality. our motivations, intentions behind our acts. And most of you know that Buddhism has this kind of little bit complicated issue around self. You know, and we say there's kind of no self. Kind of. But if anything qualifies, nothing qualifies itself as a self for Buddhists really, but the closest thing that would qualify to a self in Buddhism would be our intention. Because everything else is kind of out of our control. But our intentionality is something where the choice is. A choice involves some kind of control, some modicum of control at least. Our bodies change radically, or the world around us changes without our control, or we get sick, or bank statement goes up and down without our control, seemingly.
Stock market.
But our intentionality is something our intention is something we can bring to each moment. And there's two things going on for us at any given moment. There's what is happening to us, and is how we respond to it. And part of what how we respond to it has to do with the intentions we have. And it's interesting to me that in the Buddhist tradition, Buddhist psychology, there are seven factors of mind that are present all the time. As long as the mind is working and you're aware and kind of, there's seven factors of mind that are always present. Like there's some amount of paying attention, there's some concentration, there's some directedness of mind, there's some energy, different things. One of those seven is intentionality. Intention is always there. And the more you practice, the more your mindfulness gets stronger and stronger, it's phenomenal. It's astounding how much choice you have. When I came back from living at the monastery for 3 years, I realized that I had a choice about how I sat in the chair. And that was consequential. Before I went to the monastery, I didn't think I had any choice. It never even occurred to me that it was an issue of choice. You sit in your chair, you sit in the chair. You know, and you slouch, you do whatever you do. But coming back from the monastery where there was so much mindfulness of the body and mindfulness of activity, I realized that sitting in a chair there was a wide range of choices of how I decided to sit in the chair. You know, cross my legs, slouch, sit up straight, all these different ways. And the choices were there whether I knew it or not. And often what happens is a lot of our choices are somewhat unconscious or subconscious. Most of us, I mean, pay attention tomorrow. Most of you are going to sit in your chair tomorrow. Pay attention how many of the times tomorrow you find yourself sitting in a chair in a certain posture and you were not aware of the choice that went into the particular posture you took. I suspect that a lot of you don't give it much thought. But there is choice there, and choice is somewhat subconscious. So there's what's happening, and it's our response to what's happening, the intention. And conscience, in the way the early founding kind of people of this country talked about it, it seemed to have a lot to do with freedom of choice. But conscience also has to do, I believe, with our sense of, I don't know quite how to describe it, but without sounding moralistic, but it has to do with our sense of a little bit our right and wrong, and reviewing our activities to realize, you know, is my conscience clear? Have I done anything that leaves any feelings of misgiving or regret? Conscience has to do, in Buddhist terms, our conscience has to do entirely with intention. Probably one of the close synonyms to conscience in Buddhism is karma. Or an important element of Buddhist idea of karma is conscience. That the intentions and choices we make today affect our conscience, either immediately, it's called instant karma, we lie and then we feel bad about it right away, or maybe it's 10 years later. When I was at this car dealership, it was phenomenal the number of lies that I was told. I've never been around someone who I decided that I couldn't trust anything they were saying. And I had no sense of that they were aware of any instant karma. But I could see, you know, one of these people, his eyes were kind of demented. As soon as he walked in, you know, I was really fortunate because the general manager was going to come and talk to me about the deal. And that he came in and just eyes. You know, this is a demented man. And proceeded with, I couldn't trust, I felt I couldn't trust him for anything. Unfortunately, I realized later that I could trust him for less than I actually did. And I didn't trust him to begin with. And so I say this not to, I felt mostly sorry for him. I felt there was a tremendous amount of pain and suffering there. But it might be 20 years later that conscience kicks in. And you kind of, what have I done? Or somehow suddenly the mind, kind of the veils of the mind lift up. And the person realizes, what have I done? I spent this life doing this thing. And then hopefully, rather than feeling guilty or feeling self-hate or something, there's an opportunity to wake up. And then to focus on the intention and choices we make from there on. It doesn't make much sense from Buddhist analysis of things to harp regretfully or jealously or angrily on what you've done in the past. We learn from what we've done in the past and then focus on our intentions for the future. Our intentions are really sacred, our aspirations. Intentions shape a lot of who we are and who we become. And so rather than kind of lingering in the past out of regret or whatever, to use the past as a support to try to look into the future how we could do better. And our intentions are a tremendous refuge, a tremendous source of beauty that all of us have, our aspirations. It's hard to follow through on our aspirations and our best intentions. But to have them is really, really, really significant. I'll tell you about a dream I had last night. My wife told me to keep it short. I was in this kind of like Buddhist monastery, and there was this right-hand disciple of this woman meditation master who was kind of a fundamentalist meditation teacher. And this right-hand student of hers was kind of arrogant. And I was in this place, I had this task to do, which had to do with computers. And I went to the computer, and the keyboard was gone. So I couldn't get to the computer. So this arrogant kind of right-hand man and this meditation master came up to me, and he kind of scowled and kind of was really angry. And he kind of said to me, if you go back there to the garden in this monastery and go out in the row between the beets and the carrots and straight out to where the cliff is and look down over the cliff, you might see down there your keyboard. And it was obvious, he had thrown it down there. And so my response in the dream was something like this. It seems that there's a lot of tension here between us, a lot of animosity. I don't really want this kind of animosity between us. Is there something that I've done in the past or something we can talk about that would kind of somehow try to make things a little bit easier? And that was the end of the dream. Then I woke up. And I reflected, wow, what a dramatic difference. And that was really great. I was kind of proud of myself. That in my dream at least. I hadn't been reactive. I hadn't gotten angry or upset or hurt. I just kind of matter-of-factly kind of expressed this intention to try to kind of heal whatever the rift was. I had no idea why I was there. But I kind of expressed it kind of matter-of-factly, and I wasn't attacking him or being defensive, and he kind of softened a little bit. So I had came with this intention that I was really great. But the other part of the dream was very interesting. Was this right-hand man of this famous meditation teacher, he had attained some great meditative state, according to that system. And his intention was still that of arrogance and animosity. And it's possible to have great spiritual attainment of certain types, and still, the intentions by which a person bases their life on can still be intentions of greed and hate and anger and things like that. And it's possible for someone else to have no great spiritual attainment, but their intention to live a good life, to be generous, to be compassionate, to try to have heartfelt connection to people, can be there in abundance. Which is more important? The spiritual attainment or a lifetime of good intent? And yes?
I don't quite quite understand then the definition of spiritual attainment if that doesn't bring along with it these other things.
That's a very good point and a good reservation about the issue. Well, it does happen that people attain certain experiences that are very profound in meditation at times. And they're honored by the tradition and all this. And sometimes it makes people worse. Because then they're someone special, you know, and then they're special, they can get arrogant and then all these things. So it's a little bit of a complicated subject. And but it's famous, not only in Buddhist circles, but in other circles too. And you know, maybe it's not the right spiritual attainments. Maybe it's, you know, or there's all kinds of things people can attain through a spiritual practice. You know, it's kind of a very broad term. So there's all kinds of things that one can accomplish through meditation practice, and some of them are actually considered to be dangerous because the tremendous traps for the ego. The mind is kind of great, pristine experiences of clarity, of concentration, of great bliss, great light. Great all kinds of things, and the person thinks I'm hot stuff, you know, and everybody else who doesn't have it is not hot. Yes, Pesha.
It sounds like the spiritual materialism that Darlene spoke about.
Spiritual materialism is a great term. So so intention doesn't answer this. So I just point to the importance of it and how Buddhism puts a lot of stress on it. And I haven't answered Cheryl's question yet about, you know, which how do we decide on what intentions we do and what intentions we follow through on. And we're running out of time. I wanted to stress that again, that mindfulness is kind of like, it doesn't necessarily mean we have to stop or to pause, but mindfulness practice is very closely akin to pausing for a moment rather than acting reactively, automatically. And in that pause, to see that we have more choice than we realized, and to see that our choices have consequences, and that our choices are flavored by a certain intention. So it isn't simply to choose to do a certain thing, but we choose often with an intention for something else. For example, you know, I might choose to end today promptly at 9 o'clock because we're supposed to. I might choose to end, but my intention to end might be more than that, more than we're supposed to. It might be that I don't want people to think that I'm long-winded, because then they'll think badly of me, and it's important that everybody here has a very nice impression of me, and you know, and all that. Well, if that's the intention for ending at 9 o'clock, that intention then, you know, is a little bit, you know, colored then or skewed in a certain kind of funny way, right? Some of you think so. So there's many spins we put in our choices, and that spin we put in our choice on our choices is called the intention, the motivation, and that has great consequences. So if two people can make the same choice, but they put different spins on it. One can be a spin of greed, another can be a spin of generosity. One person can be a spin of showing off, and the other one can be generosity or compassion. And these things have effect in our, these things help form who we are. And they help bring about, a clear and clean conscience. And I think one of the marvelous things that a person can have in life is a clean and clear conscience. And I kind of, today I've been liking this term a lot because it doesn't sound moralistic. I hope, and I don't mean it in any kind of moralistic sense at all. But to have a clean conscience is not to go to bed at night feeling regret or feeling somehow a little bit bad about the intentions and choices of the day. And end with two quotes. George Washington Carver said, "How far you go in life depends on your being tender with the young, compassionate with the aged, sympathetic with the striving, and tolerant of the weak and of the strong. Because someday in life you will have been all of these." Then Martin Luther King says, this is a very interesting thing, carrying on maybe the theme of conscience that's been part of this country for a long time. In the most difficult moments, we can match your capacity to inflict suffering with our capacity to endure suffering. We will meet your physical force with soul force. We will not hate you, but we cannot in good conscience obey your unjust laws. However, we will soon wear you down with our capacity to suffer, and in winning our freedom, we will so appeal to your conscience that we will win your freedom in the process. A person I met some years ago who was there in Mississippi in 62, 63 or whatever, and she showed up in the same place to demonstrate for integration. And she stood there. And each day, these white people came and beat her up. You know, isn't that kind of dumb? They show up, we're going to beat you up, I'm staying here, they beat her up. She comes back the next day, we're going to beat you up, I'm not leaving, okay, we beat you up. The third day, she stood there. She looked up at one of the people who was going to hit her, and she caught his eye, and he stopped, and it changed him. And he stopped, and he started talking. He couldn't do it anymore. Something about the person willing to take that abuse reached deep into his heart and stopped him in a way that any kind of political arguing back and forth probably never would have. So I'm not advocating we all stand in the way of, but it's powerful, I think, what Martin Luther King said. We will win our freedom, and in winning our freedom, we will so appeal to your conscience that we will win your freedom in the process. So to sit in mindfulness, to sit quietly, peacefully, to start paying attention to our inner life and our reactivities, our choices, to become familiar with our desires and our hatreds, our aversions, when they arise in our sitting, and know the difference between jumping on the train of desire and aversion and letting it go like a wave just passes through, and just, oh, there it is, passing through. And to be able to cultivate some spaciousness, some awareness, some calmness around our choices is tremendously powerful. And it's tremendously powerful to do that by sitting every day. And in sitting every day, create a very strong foundation to bring it into our daily life. And so then eventually, maybe we also can have the inner strength, what Martin Luther King called soul force. So we can have that also. So when we're really called upon to use our deepest resources in situations, that we have them there because we know ourselves well enough. So thank you all. And now you all. And maybe soon I'll answer Cheryl's question.